for having me. So here's the title, Mutual Information and the Structure of Entanglement in Quantum Field Theory. It's a bit of a mouthful, so if you ever try to calculate anything about entanglement, the one thing everyone agrees is that it's extremely hard to calculate. So hopefully, a subtitle could be sort of a do-it-yourself kit for entanglement. So at the end of this talk, hopefully you'll have some idea of how you can, in 5 minutes in your office, figure out how entanglement goes in a quantum field theory. Okay? And please ask any questions if you have them. Okay, so here's the question we want to address. What happens when many local degrees of freedom interact? Okay, this is a picture of unit cell of YBCO, a famous high-PC superconductor. Okay, there's lots of little blobs. And some of these blobs have electrons on them, right? So the point is that in a many-body system, you have a lot of local Hilbert spaces called HI. And the total system is a big quantum system, which is the tensor product of all these local spaces. Okay. So what about the state? Well, there's a very old approximation in many-body theory, which is the mean field theory, where you take your quantum state and you approximate it as a state on each site, independent of the other sites, right? This is some kind of product approximation. This works well for symmetry-breaking phases, like the antiferromagnets, valence bond crystals, things like that. Okay. But there exist phases of matter called topological phases where mean field theory can fail qualitatively. That is, it gives completely the wrong answer, not just, you know, you don't get your TC exactly right. You just, you know, don't even capture the qualitative physics of the phase. Right?
Why do you say that antiferromagnetic is roughly of that form? Antiferromagnetic is a huge superposition of many.
No, I mean, if you pick a particular, so suppose you fix the boundary, like you apply it on a small magnetic field.
So ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic?
Antiferromagnetic. I mean, you know, it looks like this, right? Looks like up, down, up, down. Right. If you pick a particular direction, right, so you break the symmetry. I'm not, you know, I mean, of course, if you have a finite-sized system, a small finite-sized system, then the state will be a superposition of all of these. It can be a superposition of all of these. But if you introduce a very small symmetry-breaking perturbation, you'll pick a particular direction in which to order. Right. So this is a caricature of the phase and of the state in that situation. Okay. And the way we talk about this is that, you know, like I said, for n spins, let's say, the dimension of the Hilbert space is really large, right? This is like 2 to the 10 to the 23. It's a really, really big number, okay? And almost all states in this space are not of this form. They're not even close. Okay, so they're entangled, and that just means you can't write them as product states. And more than that, they're highly entangled, okay? So why study entanglements? Well, it's sort of the material from which phases of matter are built, right? It's what ties together different regions in the theory, in the ground states, right? When you have superpositions of product states for your general state, then entanglement is saying that this superposition exists, right? So you have all these different local states which are tied together in some way. Okay. The second thing is that if you understand something about entanglement, then you understand where to look in this enormous Hilbert space for interesting quantum states, right? Do I need to, you know, is it enough to focus on product states, or, you know, do I need to look at random states, or what's the structure of Hilbert space, right? And this third thing is kind of more of a hope. It's just saying that, you know, this 2 to the n is too big of a number. We don't, you know, no one's ever calculated, you know, the exact ground state for Hubbard model on 100 by 100 site, because it's just 100 by 100 lattice, it's just too big, right? So somehow, most of this 2 to the n is not relevant for many-body physics. And we want to understand, you know, how to think about the many-body system without thinking about this sort of irrelevant stuff out in Hilbert space that you can never get to, that never affects you. And like I said, we really don't have a choice because it's there in everything. Okay. So based on the things that people are interested in at Perimeter, I thought of some concrete questions you can keep in mind as I talk. The first is about quantum states. So does entanglement structure of quantum field theory tell us anything about what sorts of states you might be interested in? You know, what part of Hilbert space should you focus on? Okay. Another question is something about theory space. So, you know, in condensed matter physics, we have a lot of different materials, a lot of different low energy theories. So you can ask, you know, is there some structure to the space of theories? You know, can I order them in some way, or what can I say about this space, right? What kind of theories can come from what kind of lattice models and this sort of thing? And finally, something I'm interested in is holographic duality. And so you can ask the question, does this duality, you know, provides access to certain kind of large and strong coupled gauge theories in a very nice way. But the question is, how generic are these theories? You know, should I take what I hear from holographic duality very seriously for ordinary theories, or, you know, is it really something very special? Okay. So I'll try to shed light on all these questions as I go along. Okay, so here's the outline. So first I'll tell you a little bit about the basics of entanglement, and then some useful tools, and then mutual information will enter, and I'll talk about some recent development, just a few days old in the archive, about how you can try to calculate entanglement in many body states and in applications. Okay. So here's the setup. So this is my big many body system. All right. Maybe it's periodic matter conditions or something. So A is some region of interest. Here it's a sphere. A circle. Right? And B is sort of everything else. Right? So you take the ground state of the entire system, you trace out B, and that forms the reduced density matrix for A. Okay. And this reduced density matrix contains all the information you need to describe measurements done in region A only. Okay. And as I said, you know, we want to understand what the structure of entanglement in this thing is. So how entangled is A with B, right? So one simple measure of that is this von Neumann entropy or entanglement entropy, where you take the reduced density matrix of A and you trace over A with this rho log rho form. Okay. So if A and B are in a product state, that is, there's no entanglement, then S is just zero. Okay. And crudely speaking, E to the S is some measure. E to the S is like the number of states you need to keep in order to describe how entangled A and B are. Okay. So it's some measure of entanglement. Okay. So we want to ask, how does this thing behave in a many-body system? So as you probably all heard, there's this famous boundary law for this quantity. Okay. Which says that SA in this case would just scale as L. So it scales as the linear size of the boundary, right? Now, rather than just state that, I'm going to try to give you some intuition for why that should be true. Okay. So let's think about, since we're doing many body physics, and particularly I'm talking about quantum field theory, so I'm going to be interested in the low energy limit. So I should think about doing some kind of RG transformation. Okay. So let me introduce a variable Z, which is a length scale, which is small in the UV and large in the infrared, okay? I guess what I said. So this little light, this blue epsilon is the UV cutoff, some length scale, like a lattice spacing, and Z goes to infinity in the infrared, okay? And the RG transformation, typically you flow towards zero momentum, so it's like momentum shell RG and standard kind of stat-mech thing, although for some systems this is not true, okay? I'll come back to that later. So how can we understand the boundary law? Well, when I make an RG transformation, I take Z and I multiply it by some multiplicative factor, right, e to the dl. Okay. So solving, you get dl is dz over z. So this is like the integration measure when I'm doing RG. Right? I have these logarithmic intervals, and I just sum over all these logarithmic intervals. Okay. So now we want to make an assumption about the entropy as a function of this Z, the entanglement entropy, to recover the boundary law. So let's introduce this idea of entanglement per scale. So if I normalize the system to scale Z, right, then I have some Hamiltonian which is local at scale Z, right? It may be non-local for smaller scales, but it's local at scale Z, right? And the idea is this local Hamiltonian at scale Z entangles A in its environment along the boundary, right? So roughly speaking, the amount of entanglement that comes from scale Z is the size of the boundary measured in units of the local scale, and then this is just accounting for the dimension of the thing. So if D is equal to 2, D is the spatial dimension. This is just L over Z. If D is equal to 1, this is just a constant, right? So each scale contributes the same amount of entanglement. Okay.
Why would you assume that local interactions at scale Z?
So you start with local interactions at the lattice scale, right?
Right.
And when you normalize, you always have local interactions at the scale that you're talking about.
So if it's local at a smaller scale, then it should be local.
Yeah, you know, once you renormalize at scale z, the interactions may be non-local for scales smaller than z, but for scale z, it should be local still. Okay. So here's what you do. You compute the entropy. You integrate from the UV cutoff to the IR cutoff of the entanglement per scale times the RG measure. So there's two situations you can consider. The first is if you have some kind of conformal field theory, right? So that means it's a scale invariant situation. In this case, the IR cutoff should be the size of the subregion you're considering, right? So if you do this integral and you get L over epsilon to the D minus 1 for D greater than 1, and you get this famous log L over epsilon for D equals 1. So again, I'm just adding up the entanglement per scale as a sum over all scales of interest, right? So this is this boundary law, right? In D spatial dimensions, the boundary goes like L to the D minus 1, right? And then in one dimension, you get this logarithmic correction, right? And the prefactor here is universal. It's the central charge of the conformal field theory. If you have a gap, so that the IR cutoff is some kind of correlation link, right? Then in D greater than 1, you get the same kind of scaling, right? The correlation link just enters as a subleading term here. And for D equals 1, you cut off this log divergence. Once big L is bigger than C, you cut it off at C. So then you get, again, boundary law for gas systems in one dimension.
So I'm a little confused here. Why do you have a scale induced at this with CFT at all? Is that just because that's the scale you're looking at?
Yeah, so I'm saying in this case, in the CFT case, there's two scales. There's just the cutoff, and there's the scale of the region you're considering.
Right.
So those are the only two scales you can enter, and that's what you find. You just find that.
Okay, and you're saying over here that there could be an additional scale.
There's an additional scale, which is the correlation.
So why does that not show up on the top?
On the top, here?
Just down there.
There.
Down up. There.
Yeah, so I'm saying it's subleading. Just do this integral from epsilon to C. There's a L over C to the D minus 1 term. So it's there, but it's just subleading. It's the same form as the boundary law. So those of you who, if you know something about tensor network states, in particular the MIRA, this is codified in the MIRA in some simple way. Also, if you know anything about holography, this is also a simplified discussion of what's happening when you compute the entanglement entropy in that case. Okay. So this is the intuition, this entanglement per scale idea.
Okay.
There is one exception which is interesting, which is that you have fermions with a
finite Fermi surface, right? So here's some two-dimensional material. This is the two-dimensional Brillouin zone. I think this is actually another high TC material. Okay, so this is the Fermi surface. So it's codimension 1 in space. So this is the Brillouin zone, two-dimensional, and this is the Fermi surface here, Fermi line. And this system has KFL log L entanglement. So it's super boundary law scaling. Okay.
Sorry, so question. Can you tell me just briefly what the axes are?
Yeah, this is just KX and KY, just momentum. So you're just plotting the locus of zero energy states in momentum space.
Okay.
So people calculated this entanglement entropy and concluded that it was had this extra log L piece. And then a little later on, I gave some intuitive understanding of this in terms of, you know, basically if you have on this line here, the excitations are radial particle hole excitations, right? So yeah, so each point you have some kind of radial mode like this, which you can excite. And so this is like a collection of one-dimensional radial modes. And you can add everything up in the right way and get exactly this answer with an exact prefactor, which you can compute. Okay. And in degrees of numerics, everything is nice. Okay. So there is this exception, but it's understood. Because basically it's sort of like, as I said here, CFT on the Fermi surface. It's like an infinite collection or a large number of 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theories.
Is there some intuition of what kind of class of exceptions this particular example would represent? Or is this just, oh, we found this? can you reduce, does it have to be CFT on the Fermi surface? Or could there be a larger class of things which would encompass this exception?
Yeah, so this is something I thought about. We've looked for exceptions to the boundary law because it's important to identify these things. And so far in higher dimensions, the only thing we know how to do as a general class is when you have many gapless one-dimensional modes, effectively one-dimensional modes. Okay. So I worked on another, and to talk about here, another situation. If you take, for example, vial fermions in a magnetic field, these also sort of have a zero mode which goes along the field lines. So there's a large number of excitations here, one-dimensional excitations, and they also violate this boundary law.
Okay.
But we don't know of any other mechanism. So in particular, like if you have a line, like if you're in three dimensions, three plus one dimensions, and you have a line, like a Fermi line instead of a Fermi surface, mm-hmm. that does not violate the boundary law. Because CFT in two plus one dimensions, which is like the radial excitation there,
yes.
doesn't violate the boundary law.
I see.
So we have some intuition, but you know, we don't know if there's other examples.
About flat band?
So is that a flat band?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, this is a little bit of a degenerate case because if you fill the band partially, you have ground state degeneracy, right? So in this case, you find that this goes with L, the number of degenerate ground states, right? But it's not a measure of entanglement. It's a measure of the fact that there are many ways to the original ground state of the entire system is actually can be an incoherent mixture of all of these ground states, right, or coherent, right? So you can get this scaling of system size, where you have a large number of degenerate ground states. But it's not related to entanglement, it's related to the fact that you have degenerate states.
If you choose one ground state and choose the...
Yeah, if you choose one ground state and then just zero.
And compute the entanglement.
Yeah, if you choose one ground state where the band is flat, you may as well just put all the particles on, you just put them all on some site, mm-hmm. right? And then there's just no entanglement. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this violation of the law is really about whether the system is effectively strongly interacting or not, at least in one of the dimensions. What I mean is, imagine you have an icing system mm-hmm. in a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
And, even at the critical point, you find the DI law.
Sorry, what dimension are we in?
Two.
Okay.
Okay? Sure. And you find the DI law. But now imagine you slowly switch off the horizontal coupling. And when it becomes really zero, you have an array of one-dimensional systems. And at the critical point, you would have the entanglement is L log L, right? Because each of them would have a log L.
So what you're saying, you want to consider basically coupled 1D Ising chains.
Yeah.
You're right.
So it's about the fact that, so this is what is happening here, right? Because you have effectively one-dimensional systems. So it's about how strongly interacting is the system or not?
Well, I would say it's just about whether there's effectively one-dimensional systems or not. They can be weakly interacting, strongly interacting. It doesn't matter. As long as there's an effective 1D decryption, then you'll have this L log L.
Yeah, I understand. But in this case, you see that for this two-dimensional Ising model, it's about the interaction,
yeah,
the direction, right?
Yeah, it's because if you turn off this, if you turn on this coupling on it at all, uh-huh. then you get a completely different answer, right? So it's not stable to, interactions between the chains, let's say.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, Okay.
All right. So next, I'm going to talk about some. So I told you sort of a little bit about entanglement.
That table that I wrote up there is sort of summarizes our knowledge of entanglement entropy calculations for, you know, large class of theories, right? So let me tell you now about some fruits of this labor, okay? So the first is this idea of tensor network states. So remember I said, you know, does entanglement help us think about where in Hilbert space to look for ground states, right? So tensor network states are a class of variational states that automatically incorporate this boundary law scaling with the entanglement entropy. Okay, so there's this fact that if you take your Hilbert space, your 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, and you choose a state at random from this space, then with very high probability this state has an entanglement entropy for subregions which grows as the size of the subregion, right? So in 2 dimensions it would be L squared, right? So from this point of view, the boundary law is really special. It's saying that ground states of Hamiltonians, local Hamiltonians, form a very, very special tiny subset of all Hilbert space. Okay. And these tensor network states are designed to capture this subspace. Okay. So the details are not important because it's not really a talk about tensor network states. But basically, this is the one-dimensional case. You have physical indices here, and then you introduce some fictitious indices, and you contract over these ijk's to produce the wave function, right, in some way. And when you cut the system, if you cut the system here and here to study the reduced density matrix of this subregion, the entanglement is just bounded by the number of the bond size cut here and the bond size cut here. Okay. And similarly, in 2 dimensions, if you cut all these bonds like that, then you just get sort of the size of each bond times the area, or times the size of the boundary. Right. So they're naturally designed to do this boundary law. Okay. And so as variational states, for these mean field states I talked about before, you know, as I said, this is the, you know, character of the antiferromagnet, but it's not the real state. I mean, the real state has some entanglement. So you can imagine, for example, that if you do a tensor network version of this, then you can obtain qualitative or quantitatively better, you know, estimates for TC or for, you know, correlation functions or whatever you care about. So it's sort of entanglement adds to your ability to describe this thing. The symmetry breaking, the mean field state is the right, you know, picture in your mind, but entanglement can help you get quantitatively better answers. But I said there are these states, topological states, where mean field theory fails qualitatively, okay? But these tensor network states can do the job. So we showed, along with Vidal and his collaborators, that for a large class of topological states in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you could describe these things using a tensor network state. And then later on, we also showed with Chirac and other people that you can also extract the topological information from these tensor network states. Right? So if I give you the tensor network state, you can, in principle, identify what phase it's in, or at least some information about it. Okay. So that's one thing which any self-respecting entanglement theorist must have in their toolbox. Okay. The other thing, I think, is ADS-CFT, holographic duality. Okay. So, again, this is not the primary focus of the talk, but let me just say a little bit about it. So in this situation, what you have is some conformal field theory, in this case, 1 plus 1, one space and one time. And the duality says it should be related to some theory of gravity in anti-de Sitter space, right? Anti de Sitter is related to the isometries, the conformal isometries of the field theory. Right, so you add one dimension and you get gravity. So here's X, the field theory X. I've not displayed time. And then here's this extra new coordinate, the radial coordinate, which I called R. And the interpretation of this radial coordinate is that it's like energy scale or length scale in the field theory. So people sometimes say the field theory lives at the boundary. Well, more properly, the field theory's ultraviolet part lives at the boundary, right? That's where R is equal to zero. So that's sort of like R equals epsilon is the ultraviolet part of the field theory. And as you go into the bulk, you probe the infrared. All right, so
what does that mean? You go into the bulk, probe it. I mean, isn't it just that really what's happening, you could think of as the UV, and then if you were to analyze effects at larger scales, they would be somehow represented by this? And what does that mean? I'm just having trouble with the terminology.
Yeah, I mean, it just means, you know, what to say. you can think of this, I mean, you don't need to have this, you know, you can describe everything in terms of the field theory.
Right.
But the idea is that somehow down here, if you think about this extra dimension, you can get a simpler qualitative picture for what's going on. For example, you know, it will be interested in entanglement entropy. So you can calculate this entanglement entropy in terms of hypersurfaces in the bulk.
Okay.
Right. So here's some region you want to care about, its entanglement entropy, right? Then you can think about this region sort of shrinking down as you go down in scale, right? The region gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's a nice picture of what's going on. And then qualitatively, you know, quantitatively, you can just compute the area of this dotted red line using the metric of this space, and that's the entanglement entropy. So it's both a picture and some kind of calculation.
Does it help you with perturbations too?
Yeah, it can. I mean, you know, in these phone coupled theories, there's not really anything else you can do in many cases. I mean, you know, you may be hard pressed to formulate a reasonable perturbation theory, you know, in this thing. I mean, you can obviously do linear response, but calculating the correlation functions is very difficult. Yeah.
But I mean, is it fair to say that the use of ADS is really just expressing the metric in the renormalization group dz over z?
It's certainly fair to say that's part of what it's doing. I'm not sure I would say that's the only thing it's doing. I mean, one of the major, you know, intuitive reasons why it's a reasonable thing to think about. But you know, I wouldn't say that's the only thing it's doing. I mean, that's the metric has to be that by conformal symmetry.
Right.
But you know, you can study all kinds of fluctuations around that metric, right? To describe, you know, the flow of heat and the boundary theory or the flow of charge, right? So so the fluctuations are also important.
The fluctuations
of the bulk metric.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah. That's what I would say. Any other questions?
So here's, like I said, the master formula. The entanglement entropy is the area of this hypersurface divided by the Planck scale, the Newton constant. Right, so this is this nice famous formula. And at large n, as I just said, the entanglement entropy is controlled entirely by the geometry. So you just draw this picture of the surface and you compute the area and that's your answer.
Okay.
So along the lines of this 1D thing, you can cook up systems in the holographic setup that also realize this sort of effectively one-dimensional physics, right? And so we showed that the solutions were provided by De Hooker and Krauss, and then I showed later on that these things have interesting entanglement structure. That is, they have this effectively one-dimensional physics going on. Okay, in this case, you put the system in a magnetic field so that basically you have gapless fermions which are moving along the field lines. So you have a whole array of these things that are sort of moving in the field direction along the field lines, some kind of zero mode. So again, it's many, many one-dimensional degrees of freedom.
Okay.
So this is like I said, I was looking hard for other ways to, you know, violate this boundary law, but you know, we never found anything else.
Okay.
So that was sort of entanglement entropy and what it can do for you. Let me go on now to mutual information. So, it's trouble in paradise. The entanglement entropy is a cutoff sensitive quantity, right? We saw before that it's this L over epsilon to the d minus 1. Okay. So, in particular, in an unregulated quantum field theory, the entanglement entropy is a divergent quantity, right? So, you know, if you go back to that table, in some ways that table is kind of boring because everything behaves the same way and, you know, everything depends on ultraviolet physics, right? So, you know, what do you learn about, you know, maybe you learn about, you know, states in general for any Hamiltonian, but you can't tell the difference between a conformal field theory and a gap system, even though they have very different physics. So the boundary law is kind of too universal. So we want to look for something which is a little more discerning.
Okay.
And in particular, you have some lattice model for some quantum system, right? And you go to low energy, you get some effective field theory, right? So we'd like to isolate as much as possible sort of what I call a low-energy structure of entanglement, right? We want to study the part which only comes from the universal low-energy physics, right? And we don't want to care about, or at least we want to separate the high-energy part from the low-energy part. So mutual information, what is it? Here's the definition.
So it's defined in terms of the entanglement entropy in this way. So you add these two guys up. So you take two regions, A and B. You compute the entropy of one, the entropy of the other, and you subtract from it the entropy of the combination of the two. Okay. And this subtraction has the effect of removing this sort of boundary law part, the UV sensitivity. Okay. So let me just tell you some properties of this thing. The first is that it's positive. This follows from subadditivity of the entropy. Okay. The second is it has this nice property that if you have a region B which contains a region C, then you have this inequality. So this is strong subadditivity. Okay. So it kind of, you know, it's a monotone quantity when you consider region size. And then finally, it's also interesting because it bounds connected correlation functions. So you take an operator OA and OB, and A and B respectively, and you compute their connected correlation function and you square it, and that's bounded by the mutual information. Right? These terms are just here to ensure that you can't cheat by making the operator, you know, just by multiplying it by a big number. Right? So these are just normalizing the correlation function. Okay. So what does this thing do for us? Right? What does this quantity do for us? Right? So let me talk first about Dirac fermions. So I'm going back to the 1 plus 1 dimensional case. Everything's always simpler in 1 plus 1 dimensions. Dirac fermions are a nice system because everyone cares about them. If you're doing condensed matter, they're quantum wires. If you're doing string theory, they're the world sheet. If you're doing quantum computing, they can, you know, figure out the NAND tree for you. They have a lot of virtues. But one thing which is really nice from my point of view is that you can compute the mutual information exactly in this theory. Okay, and here's what it looks like. Just some function of L and X. This is just for two intervals of length L separated by distance X. So I just have two blocks, and there's a distance X between them. Right. So this is the formula, right? There's no epsilon appearing, which is good. So that means it's really a property of the low energy theory. And this 1/3 here is related to the central charge, C over 3.
Way, like for instance, if it doesn't have to do with the ridiculously small scale entanglement across the boundary, which you're now discarding.
Exactly. So if you go back to this formula, right, you can think about this sort of like has a part which comes from the small scale stuff around the boundary of A.
Yes.
And this has a part which comes from the small scale stuff around the boundary of B. Mm-hmm. And this has the same thing if A and B are disjoint. Right, so you're keeping the part which sort of talks to the which from in which A talks to B, but you're throwing away the part in which they talk to their sort of high energy neighbors.
I see. I got you.
Okay. Okay. So then let's return to this idea of entanglement per scale. You can notice if I take X to zero, the mutual information diverges. Okay, in fact, it diverges logarithmically, and in fact, this divergence is quite general. Let me just write it down. In every case, it goes like C over 3 log L over X. Right? So you get in this formalism this central charge, but in a completely finite setting, right? L and X are both well-defined continuum quantities, so there's no cutoff, right? This kind of makes sense because what happens is when these regions come together and touch, then the subtraction that I talked about can't happen anymore. Right? So you have to recover this divergence. Okay. All right, so let's consider now D plus one dimensional case. So the simplest thing you can think about is just two flat regions. So if you're doing D equals 2, right? You maybe have something here, right, like this. So you have two flat regions, A and B, and you consider them as they come together. So you bring this distance small. Oops. And then the boundary law, again, tells you that this thing has to diverge at some power of X, and the power is just the size of this region, so the size of this width here, times the appropriate 1 over x factor. Right. And now this coefficient k which again we want to interpret as the entanglement per scale, because there's similar. This is like a scaling. You know, this is saying that sort of the entanglement that's coming from this. You know, 1/x is a function of x. This thing is now universal, right? It was a central charge in one dimension. It's some kind of new quantity which measures how many degrees of freedom are participating in terms of their entanglement. Okay. Yeah.
Why do you keep talking about entanglement?
Yeah, it's a...
Because you have all sorts of correlations in the visual.
Yeah, of course. So this is a very good point. In fact, you know, especially far away, the correlations really become important. I mean, you know, in thinking in terms of correlations, right? So, what, you know, I don't have to defend it too clearly here, but you know, basically the idea is that, you know, for the short distance part, it's really just telling you about the entanglement between, it's just the entanglement and not the sort of more ordinary correlations. This is just recovering the boundary law part. It's like the high energy entanglement per scale. But entanglement is just a word. I mean, this is just what mutual information does, right? You don't have to call it entanglement. I just call it that because it's a useful heuristic. But.
So you just mean correlation between them?
Well, so the mutual information is just, it doesn't distinguish between classical and quantum correlations, right?
That was all
just. Yeah, that's his point. So,
so you're not distinguishing that.
So in principle, yeah, I'm not claiming that this is somehow just entanglement or something like that. Okay. It's clearly related to entanglement, this short distance singularity, but I wouldn't claim that it's somehow only entanglement. Right. So yeah, that's absolutely a great point. Okay. So you can do other geometries. So here I made a nice picture. You can have some kind of curved geometry now, right? And here the regions don't touch on a surface, they touch at a point, right? So in the generically this point will have a finite curvature, right, which is what I've drawn here, right? And you can do some scaling argument and you discover in this case that it's, instead of d minus 1, it's d minus 1 over 2. So you get the square root of 2, which basically comes from the quadraticness of the surface, right? You can also do sharp corners, and they give a logarithmic divergence in any dimension. So they're sort of always recalling the one-dimensional result, right? So let me tell you a little bit about the holographic computation, okay? If you have two regions in the that you want to compute, then you need to have two red bars on the boundary, right? And again, the entanglement entropy is always just the minimal surface area, right? So there's sort of two possibilities. Either these regions can join to each other, like this, I mean, join to themselves, right? Or they can join to each other, like that, right? And in fact, this surface wins when the regions are close together, and this one wins when they're far apart, right? So this is like SA plus SB, and this is some kind of, you know, connection between the two of them, right? And so all those scaling laws that I wrote down before can be checked holographically, and they all give the right answer, yeah.
What are the particular theories in 1 plus 1 and 2 plus 1 that are dual in this way?
Well, so, I mean, the simplest would be in 3 plus 1 you have n equals 4.
No. In the example that you're using, these are 1 plus 1 dimensions.
Yeah, this is 1 plus 1, or in, what I considered was if you have these kind of long regions like this, like bars, then you can just assume translation invariance and suppress the other directions.
Okay.
So they all sort of end up looking like the 1 plus 1 dimensional case.
And what are you using for the dual theory in 2 plus 1?
I mean, I'm always just computing on the gravity side, so I don't know what the theory is on the field theory side. It's just some only coupled gauge theory. I mean,
on the boundary.
Yeah, on the boundary.
Right, and in the bulk, when you say it's gravity, you mean?
I just mean Einstein gravity.
In the appropriate, in 2 plus 1.
In this case, you know, for 1 plus 1 CFT, it's 2 plus 1 Einstein gravity. For, you know, 2 plus 1 CFT, it's 3 plus 1 Einstein gravity, and so on.
Right, and you're just computing.
I'm just computing the area of the surface.
You're just computing the area of the minimal surface there.
That's all I'm doing.
In the ADS space.
In the ADS space.
So just to come back to sort of so the dynamics of gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensional space doesn't play a role, or it does play a role?
It does not play a role in this calculation. I mean, you just take the static background geometry and compute some area in it.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, this is important because if you separate these things far away, then, you know, like I said, they're just it's just SA plus SB. So SA and B is just SA plus SB. So I is zero. That can't be true unless nothing is correlated, you know, far away. So you need to include fluctuations to capture the long distance behavior correctly. But the short distance part, sort of large n part, like there's basically in the holographic setup, there's an n squared in front of all of these things. Right, so that sort of n squared part can be captured just from the background geometry. But you have to include the fluctuations to capture sort of the long distance behavior.
So I understand what the n is in the 3 to 4 dimensional case. What is the n in the 1 to 2 dimensional case?
Well, all I mean by n is just, you know, the ADS radius divided by the Planck length to some power. So it's just whatever you're assuming is large. You know, that's all I mean.
So in this picture, you said they're far enough away, the mutual information is zero.
Mm-hmm.
So are you saying that this picture is only useful when they're reasonably close together?
Yeah, I'm saying the geometric part of the calculation, just the minimal surface part, when they're far away, gives I equals zero. Okay.
Oh, I see. So the correlations can only come from fluctuations.
So the correlations can only come from fluctuations. So in other words, it's not mysterious. It's just saying there's no n squared or you know, or n to whatever power or whatever n is. There's no big part.
Okay.
You can compute the smaller part, which just comes from, you know, doing fluctuations in the bulk, right? So whatever fields you have in your classical theory, you just run loops of those in the bulk, and you can compute corrections to this thing.
Okay.
So onto this twist fields, right? So I gave you some scaling forms. Now let's talk about how you can actually compute something. Okay, so what about in the field theory? Well, the way people usually do it is via replica trick, right? So you take a bunch of copies of your space-time. Here it's 2 plus 1 dimensional, right? And you just write this partition function which computes the trace of the reduced density matrix for R to some power n. And you take a derivative, evaluate n equals 1, and that gives you the entanglement entropy, right? So you need to know, in principle, you can compute this n for every integer n out to infinity. And if you have enough control over these things, then you can find an analytic function and take its derivative, right? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you get it's e to the n log rho, so you just get rho log rho. Yeah. Okay. So in 1 plus 1 dimension, you can do it as follows. So you consider consider our interval of length L. So you have some field psi, and you take n copies of them. So alpha is 1 to n, right? And tau is imaginary time. So the boundary condition, let me just draw this out because it can be a little confusing. So here's imaginary time, and here's x, and here's my interval. So all it says is that if I come from below, from imaginary time below to imaginary time above, psi alpha becomes psi alpha plus 1, right? So that's what these things are called, twist fields. They're just moving you from one alpha to the next alpha as you go around, right? And again, this is just basically expressing the fact that in this replica formalism, what happens is that you move from one sheet to the next sheet as you go around this condition, as you go around this boundary, right?
Okay.
So just some boundary conditions, right? But the important thing is that this replica spacetime, this n copies glued together in a certain special way, is locally unexceptional. It looks like flat space everywhere, except at the ends of the interval, right? And so the idea is maybe I can write this z of r as expectation value of some operator sitting at these two points in spacetime, right? That's just this point here, tau equals 0, x equals 0, and this point, tau equals 0, x equals L. Right. So there are some operators, magic operators, that you put into, you compute the average in the n-copy theory, and you compute the average of these operators, and you get the entanglements. You get this partition function. Okay. So what happens in higher dimensions? Well, the twist fields are point-like in 1 plus 1, right, because they're at a fixed imaginary time and at the ends of an interval, right? So they're just points. So in 2 plus 1, they become line operators, and in 3 plus 1, they become surface operators, and so on, right? And so the idea is, again, we should associate an operator to every point on this boundary, right? That's what we did over there. So I want to define a new something which I called kn of r, right, which is an operator that when you take its expectation value in the n-copy theory, gives you this reduced density matrix to some power. Okay. So here's the guess that I wrote down. So like I said, this thing should be the product of sort of operators at each point on the boundary. So here the boundary is a manifold. In the two-dimensional case, 2 plus 1-dimensional case is a line. So what I should do is take this thing, I should exponentiate some sum of operators over each point on the boundary, right? And this is a product of operators on the boundary, right? And what I want to do is I want to make some assumptions about this phi field to sort of try to calculate the entanglement entropy. And this is reasonable because in 1 plus 1 dimensions, these twist fields turn out to be primary fields, so they have some scaling dimension, and they're nice. And more importantly, you can also think of them as exponentials of a massless boson, right? So here I want to treat this as some kind of massless field in conformal field theory. Okay, so what, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Good.
Thanks.
So this is a little bit confusing part. I'm going to make an assumption, which is I'm going to assume that these things are Gaussian fields. Okay. Now this can't be true in almost all cases. Maybe there's one case where it's true or close to being true, but it's in general can't be true, especially for the long distance parts. But what we'll find is that it does capture the short distance singularity structure correctly. This is also something you can expect from 1 plus 1 dimensions, because the short distance singularity there depends only on the central charge, which is just the two-point function of these guys, right? So the two-point function probably controls the short distance stuff, or at least may control it. But the long distance part is more complicated.
Okay.
But if I assume this phi is Gaussian correlated, then I just need to tell you what its two-point function is. So here's what I'm going to do. I assume that the vector field, so it has these indices. Let's just pair them up like that, right? And then this thing is integrated over some d minus one dimensional surface, right? So I just take it to be a scaling field with dimension d minus one, right? So it's a very natural assumption, right? I was integrating over some d minus one dimensional surface, so I just assume that phi is d minus one dimensional, scaling dimension d minus one, okay? So let's do some calculations. So I haven't told you what lambda n does. It's just some number. In the 1 plus 1 dimensional case, lambda n is like the square root of the scaling dimension of the twist field. And that scaling dimension it goes to 0, n equals 1, but it has a finite derivative there, right? This lambda has to go to 0 as n goes to 1, because that's the limit of one replica, which is just, you're just doing trace rho, which is just 1. Okay, so this is just normalization. But we can assume that lambda n squared has a finite first derivative at n equals 1. This is supported by this 1 plus 1 dimensional setup. Okay. Did I hear a question? So then all we need to do is take the expectation value of this thing and its derivative, and we get this formula. So I calculate the derivative of this lambda n squared at n equals 1, which I assumed is finite. There's just a 1/2. And there's a double integral over the boundary of R times these normal vectors, right, times this correlation function. That's the entanglement entropy in this setup.
Okay.
So let's do some calculations. For the circle in two dimensions, of course, this thing has to be divergent, right? Because the entropy is ultraviolet cutoff sensitive, right? And indeed, you know, when you're doing this double integral over the boundary of R, when the points come together, you get some UV divergence that you have to regulate. Okay. So you can regulate that divergence, and you get a C1 L over epsilon plus C2 plus order epsilon. Okay. So this is just what the entanglement entropy should look like for a circle in two dimensions. Right. So it has the right scaling structure. I'm not claiming anything about these coefficients. They're just things you computed. But it has the right scaling structure. Okay. If you do a sphere in three dimensions, you get this term, this boundary law term, plus an interesting subleading logarithm. Right. And this term is known in 3 plus 1, comes from anomalies, from these vial anomalies, the scaling anomalies, right? So this special log term, which in fact appears in any odd spatial dimension, is reproduced by this formalism. Okay. Another general feature, if you have corners, so if you have a region like this, if you have a circle with a sharp corner somewhere, you get some logarithmic divergence. Okay? And that's also reproduced. This logarithmic divergence happens in any dimension. This is familiar from calculations of Wilson lines and gauge theory, if you've ever done that calculation. It's called a cusp anomalous dimension. Yeah? Yeah, so there, well, you take the right thing. So instead of d minus 1, you know, if d is equal to 1, you just put log. If you do log, then you get the same answer. In fact, if you put this log in there, you get this incorrect answer of Cardi and Calabrese for the entanglement entropy for any set of intervals. So that answer is correct for free fermions. It's not correct for anything else, right? So that's why I say there's at least one theory where this formalism may be true, which is maybe Dirac fermions or something like that, where the Gaussian approximation is justified. But in general, you need to take high order correlation functions of these phis to get things right. Okay. So talk a lot about the mutual information. So here's how you compute it. You just do the subtraction, right? SA plus SB minus SANB, right? And now something really nice happens. It's just integral over boundary of A, integral over boundary of B, and this correlation function, right? This is a perfectly finite quantity. Yeah, where'd that go? Oops. Yeah, for a single region, it's just double integral over the boundary, right? So this self-entanglement term cancels out, and you just get this sort of correlation part. Okay, so you can do this case again, like colliding flat regions, right? In D equals 2, for example. So if I parameterize these two lines, you know, suppose I consider it just a translation invariant situation. So something like this. Right. Then this is L here, the length of this thing, and I bring these things together, right? I can do this integral very simply. The normals are just anti-parallel, right? This guy's normal is this way, and this one's normal is that way, so they just dot product to minus 1. And then this is y1, this is y2, so this is the distance between the two points. There's x squared, y1 minus y2 squared. You do this integral, you get L over X, which is what we said before. Okay. So you recover this same universal singularity in the mutual information from this twist operator formalism. Okay. All right, so now let me just say something about these questions I raised at the beginning. Do we know where to look in Hilbert space? Is there any structure to, you know, space of theories, and what about holographic duality? Okay, so the first, something that some people in the room have thought about, we might be interested in identifying quantities that are monotonic under the RG flow, right? In 1 plus 1 dimensions, there's this nice C theorem, which says that the central charge always decreases when you flow under the RG, right? So this is some structure to theory space. It's saying this CFT can flow to this one, but this one can't flow to that one. So like the graph of all RG flows is an ordered graph, right? So there's some evidence, not great evidence, but there's some speculation that this sort of entanglement per scale, this mutual information quantity, can provide such a monotone in more than one dimension, right? So in one dimension, it reproduces central charge. For holographic theories with certain kind of bulk matter content, it can be checked again. And so we just don't know. It's an open question, but it's an interesting possibility. And it's more interesting because you can also consider flows outside of the class of CFTs. You can consider Fermi liquids. You can consider, you know, Z not equal to 1, you know, quantum field theories, right? Some kind of dynamical exponents, right? So you can try to generalize this conjecture, this entanglement conjecture, to all those things as well, right? And then, you know, you have a sort of more general setup. So this is the possibility. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, like I said, we'd like to know when can we trust holography to give us sensible answers, right? And what I just want to say is that, you know, a lot of people have worked on this you know, question of entanglement in holography, and I just think that, you know, especially, you know, with what I've done and what other people have done, there's a lot of evidence that the qualitative structure of entanglement of this kind of stuff is captured correctly, right? That, you know, the number is not right in front, but it gives you the right intuitive picture, okay? So that can be very useful. And quantum information is sort of like the basic, like I said, it's the basic building block. So it's sort of maybe the first place you want to start a systematic comparison of holographic systems and more ordinary systems. Another application along this tensor networks is, there, again, I mentioned this MIRA, right? A lot of what I said has an analog in the MIRA framework, multiscale entanglement renormalization, ANSATS, so this thing. These pictures in terms of minimal surfaces and everything, I wrote a paper some time ago about the connection between holography and MIRA, entanglement renormalization. And, you know, everything I've said here has some kind of connection in that case as well. Okay, so it appears that the MIRA is especially well-suited to capture the sort of structure of CFTs. Okay. The other thing is, if you think about this mutual information at finite temperature, which really brings us back to the correlation issue there, it's not just entanglement at all, it's really correlations, right? And if you know this is a function of temperature, you know basically everything about the CFT, right? And this is also, you know, in 1 plus 1, you can compute this in some cases. And with this twist operator formalism, you know, it may be possible to explore this sort of finite temperature regime in a, you know, in a reasonably straightforward way. Okay. So there's a lot to do. In particular, the you know, long distance part is confusing, but there's a lot of exciting prospects. So thank you for your attention. These are my collaborators. Xiaogang is my advisor. John Mavrivi is a string theorist. Senthil is a commits matter. This is Mason, a good friend of mine, Michael Levin, and Zhengcheng Gu. All right, so thank you very much.
I have a question. Yeah. This universal factor in front of the divergent when you're doing this, can you relate this to, say, the two-point function of the momentum tensor?
I think so. Like, for example, this coefficient of the log of this cusp is, the coefficient of the log in 3 plus 1 dimensions, it can be calculated in terms of A and C, right? These anomalies which appear in the stress tensor. So there's some suggestion that, yeah, you can do that. But we don't know in general what the relationship is.
Any other questions? So I don't have a question. Mm-hmm. So were you mentioning in the last slide, do you think this method is useful also to study the quantum critical region? Is what you said?
Yeah, well, I mean, so I was considering primarily CFTs. I'm already at the quantum critical point. Yeah, so it could be useful to study
the quantum critical point, the quantum critical region.
At
finite temperature.
Yeah.
I see. So do you have any evidence about what happened, how you happens at the crossover region? Or do you have any idea?
I mean, yeah, we know some. I mean, it's still very much an early stage, but yeah, I mean, basically, you know, this twist field can have various scales in it. It can have the temperature, it can have like the correlation link from the, you know, whatever you're coming from, let's say, right? And so these scales interact in some way. You can get, you know, interesting, you know, critical exponents and things like this out of these. So there's some kind of, again, there's some kind of universal crossover function, which is the two-point function of this twist field, which will control the short distance part. Right, so there's like a crossover between the CFT part and then the exponential decay, and you know, so yeah, you can see some things, but we don't really know the full range of possibilities yet. But.
So if there are no more questions, let's thank Brian. Staying until tomorrow.